Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining me today is Lisa Chamberlain, Vice President and Managing Partner of the Chamberlain Group in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The Chamberlain Group has designed custom models for medicine since 1999. But Lisa Chamberlain began in movie special effects. What a story. Lisa Chamberlain, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start a little bit about you before we get into this extraordinary story.
I went as far as drama school at Yale in theater management, going for an MFA. And I really moved in the direction of film production. Went off to my internship to New York to a company called R. Greenberg Associates. And I stayed because they offered me a job.
Interesting. So now you're at this company, and tell us what happened there.
This little company was owned by two brothers, Robert and Richard Greenberg, and they had gotten involved in doing graphic design work, opening titles and teaser trailers, but also they were doing visual effects. And there I met some really smart, talented, clever people, some of whom are still my closest friends today. This is where I met Eric, who is my husband today and my partner in the Chamberlain Group. And several other people who actually work with us now are from Greenberg Associates.
And why did you leave Greenberg?
I really was a New England kid, and I wanted to go back to New England. So I woke up and said, you know, I'm living in New York. It's not the life I want. By November, I had a job.
And what were you doing then?
Well, I came as a producer for the visual effects group.
So how long did you stay there, and what led to the next step?
We had gotten awarded the special effects camera system for the movie The Matrix. Eric was running the physical effects departments, which was model making, motion control, special camera systems, mechanical effects.
Where did he learn all that?
He is a natural engineer, though he is really somebody who learns by doing. He had a degree in history, took the 10-year plan going through college, went to Vietnam in the middle of it all, got out, thought he would be a fine artist, then thought he would be an architect, worked for an architect, always built things.
What happened then?
We're living in the Berkshires. We really want to stay here. That's our priority number one. We get a phone call from a guy who says, I hear from your silicone supplier, you guys are great model makers. Do you want to make medical models? And we say, sure, what's that? Just like that. So he comes and he brings us a project. And the project was to develop a leg that was dissectable to take the saphenous vein out of the leg. We start figuring out how to do this stuff. We did know casting and molding techniques because that was part of our work in physical effects. We actually had never done prosthetics or anything like this before. But one of the things that's good about the visual effects industry, the things that everybody wants to see are the things that you've never done before, right? So for somebody to come to us and say, we really need to make these super realistic body parts for training surgeons, well, that was just another visual effect as far as we were concerned. So it didn't really intimidate us that nobody had ever done this before. And we got involved and started really getting hooked on the anatomy thing. And a light bulb went off.
Now, that's interesting. Advance a couple of years, you start your own business.
Right. Selling the work to medical device companies.
And medical school?
No, that's a different topic. We'll get to that. They were not. Medical schools and residency programs in those days really had almost nothing to do with what is broadly referred to as surgical simulation today. It has become, in the past, particularly the past 5 years, a new industry and a new way of teaching surgery that never really, really existed before.
They used cadavers.
They used cadavers, but they used cadavers in medical school to teach anatomy. But what they really did and have done is essentially an apprenticeship system, which is known in the medical field as see one, do one, teach one. And it's really the way it's done. So you've got a surgeon, you've got a resident, and they are standing at a table at a live patient performing a real surgery, and that's the way the resident learns, on your grandmother or you or me. They called residents residents in those days for one important reason, because they lived at the hospitals, lived there, on campus. That was all they did. Now, the residents are limited in the United States to 80 hours a week, which sounds enormous to those of us who work day jobs. The exposure to surgery when you are working only 80 hours a week, if you talk to any of the doctors who are out there now who have been trained in the old system, you know, guys in their 50s, 60s and above, they think it's horrendous. Also, in the old days, all that was done was open surgery. Now, we have laparoscopic surgery and robotic surgery and other kinds of small opening surgery and natural orifice surgery. So suddenly, when laparoscopic surgery was added to the table, you had twice the number of procedures. That means the chance of seeing any procedure is cut in half, and the opportunity to train on it. And suddenly, we're developing all these procedures for doing all these new kinds of fancy surgeries, and residents have fewer hours, more types of surgery, less exposure.
When we left, before you cautioned me about going to medical school first, right, we were going in two different directions. One was medical school. One was something else. What was the something
medical
else?
Medical devices.
Medical devices.
Okay. So medical devices companies, large and small, have an economic incentive to spend money with a company like ours. And their economic incentive is that they want surgeons, practicing surgeons, forget the medical students and residents, to adopt their procedures. The procedures involve devices, and the device purchasing involves money. And so they want to build their brand loyalty.
It is incredibly complicated. Have you ever been in a operating room and say, no, that's not the way you're supposed to use this model?
No. Because remember, our stuff is only done in the training environment. We go into the operating room to learn about the procedures, to see what the tissues really look like up close. But our stuff is not used in the context of the operating room.
Sure. Okay. How big is your company?
Well, we're about 20 people, and a lot of 3D technology, lots of 3D printers, lots of CNC milling to do the manufacturing.
Somebody's going to come knocking on your door and try to buy the company, right?
Well, I would talk to somebody if came knocking on the door, for sure.
So if Johnson & Johnson come or somebody else comes and say, okay, we want to own you, that's something you might do. What's next?
Well, the industry from the residency program side is changing dramatically. And what we do is becoming more and more central to the teaching of medicine today. In fact, we just did a project with a large medical device company where their CEO had said 10 months from now, no more live animal labs. So they came to us with the project and said, do you think you can accomplish this and be able to replace our animals in 10 months? And we did. You know, you asked the question about would somebody want to buy our company. There is an opportunity right now to own surgical simulation at the academic level. And I think that a medical device company that has the foresight to be able to understand that could go into this field. And one of the things, medical device companies are limited in terms of the ways in which they can put their products in front of doctors more and more and more. So if they wanted to own surgical simulation, that would be a good way to do it, would be to get into this field now, because when you put things in front of a resident, that resident becomes an attending physician, a doctor at a hospital. And if you build brand loyalty early with them, you have the opportunity.
Are you proud?
Oh, sure, I'm proud. When I allow myself to think about it, I don't really focus on, aren't we great and haven't we done great things? It's opportunities like this that give me the chance to kind of, in a very generous amount of time, relate our story that kind of make me go, wow, we did all that stuff.